Nehemiah 4. Now when Sanballat heard that they were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he jeered at the Jews. And he said in the presence of his brothers and of the army of Samaria, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore it for themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burned ones at that?" Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, "Yes, what they are building, if a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall. Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn back their taunt on their own heads and give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captives. Do not cover their guilt, and let not their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders." So we built the wall, and all the wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. But when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the repairing of the walls of Jerusalem was going forward and that the breaches were beginning to be closed, they were very angry. And they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause confusion in it. And we prayed to our God and set a guard as a protection against them day and night. In Judah it was said, "The strength of those who bear the burdens is failing. There is too much rubble. By ourselves we will not be able to rebuild the wall." And our enemies said, "They will not know or see till we come among them and kill them and stop the work." At that time the Jews who lived near then came from all directions and said to us 10 times, "You must return to us." So in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, in open places, I stationed the people by their clans, with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles and to the officials and to the rest of the people, "Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes." When our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had frustrated their plan, we all returned to the wall, each to his work. From that day on, half of my servants worked on construction, and half held the spears, shields, bows, and coats of mail. And the leaders stood behind the whole house of Judah, who were building on the wall. Those who carried burdens were loaded in such a way that each labored on the work with one hand and held his weapon with the other. And each of the builders had his sword strapped at his side while he built. The man who sounded the trumpet was beside me. And I said to the nobles and to the officials and to the rest of the people, "The work is great and widely spread, and we are separated on the wall, far from one another. In the place where you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us." So we labored at the work, and half of them held the spears from the break of dawn until the stars came out. I also said to the people at that time, "Let every man and his servant pass the night within Jerusalem, that they may be a guard for us by night and may labor by day." So neither I, nor my brothers, nor my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us took off our clothes. Each kept his weapon at his right hand. This is God's word. So yeah, my title this morning is Pain, Prayer, and Progress. And there's no progress without pain and prayer. And what we're reading here is really Nehemiah's journal entries from about 445 BC. And 141 years before this, Nebuchadnezzar marched into Jerusalem. He laid siege to it. He completely destroyed it. He burned down their gates. He destroyed the walls. He destroyed the temple. This was in 586 BC. And God's people were taken into exile in Babylon, and God's name was mocked and considered weak. His people were captured and discouraged. And Nehemiah, we read in chapter 1, he wept over the city. He wept and he prayed for months. And then he came up with a plan, because Nehemiah was cupbearer to the king. Remember this? And so he was living in the palace. He had a good position, a good job. And you think, how does a Jewish exile, how is he raised to this position? It's because he was a man of integrity, a man of trustworthiness. I mean, this is the position, you're the most trustworthy man pretty much in the kingdom, right? Because most people back then wanted to kill the kings, and the way they do that is by poisoning the food or drink. And so as the cupbearer, his job was to taste the food or drink and make sure it wasn't poisonous, so the king would live. And Artaxerxes trusted Nehemiah, and Nehemiah was a man of integrity. And so he had a good job in the palace, but his heart was with the people back in Jerusalem, and his heart desired to go back to Jerusalem and fix up the walls, fix up the temple, restore the gates, and just bless that city. And so God gave him a plan after he had prayed for a long time. God gave him a plan, and he asked for the king for permission to go back. And he asked for letters from the king to go to the forest of Lebanon and get the best wood and timber. And God granted him favor before the king. Remember, that was a big ask. He said, listen, I don't really like your foreign policy right now in Jerusalem, and I want you to change it. And that was a huge request on his part. And God, the good hand of God was upon him. And he was able to go back. In chapter 3, that's an awesome chapter that Bruce preached on last week. We see all the men working together, right? And next to him, Zadok, and next to him, Hananiah, and next to him, the Tekoites. And so you have all the people of God doing the work of God. They're all working side by side together to repair the walls around Jerusalem. You see both clergy and laity working together, nobles and commoners, groups of different trades. You had perfumers, you had Levites, you had priests. And so this is a wonderful picture, in a sense, of the church. We're all different. We have different jobs, different trades, different socioeconomic statuses. But if we work together, we can accomplish good stuff. And so it's just a great chapter on that. But whenever you're doing a good work for the Lord, Satan is going to be unhappy. But not only that, there's going to be enemies and people who oppose the work. And that's what we see in this chapter. We were introduced to Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs, and now they recruit some more. They recruit the Ammonites and the Ashdodites. And so the opposition is growing. The opposition to this work is growing. And so we're going to look at that. And the only way to progress in this life, again, is through pain and through prayer. And so first, we're going to look at pain, then we're going to look at prayer, and then we're going to look at progress. So first, the first thing they did was what I call painful words of opposition to the work. They ridiculed them. Look at verse 1 again, verse 1 and 2. Now when Sanballat heard that we were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he jeered at the Jews. And he said in the presence of his brothers and of the army of Samaria. So he's not just making fun. It's one thing if someone makes fun of you. It's another thing if he has the army of Samaria with him, right? This isn't just insult. This, he's got like backing. So this is scary. What are you feeble Jews doing? Will they restore it for themselves? Will they sacrifice? Are these fanatics going to pray the wall up? Have they any idea what they're taking on? Will they finish it in a day? They're pathetic. Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burned ones at that? Here you can even see they use exaggeration. Now, 586 BC had done some serious damage to the walls. But it's not like the gates were burned down, but it's not like the stones were charred. You know, I mean, the stones were fine. There were heaps of rubble, but they just needed to be put back up. And so, but just demeaning, exaggeration. And then Tobiah jumps in, right? In verse 3, Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, yes, what they're building. If a fox goes up on it, he'll break down the stone wall. This is like a joke, but it's like a demeaning, sarcastic, snarky joke, right? There's two types of humor. There's a good, healthy humor. Laughter is good medicine. It's good to laugh. It's good to be lighthearted. And it's good not to take yourself too seriously. But there's a dark humor. There's a dark humor that comes at the expense of others. If you're laughing and someone else is crying, that's dark humor. That's what's going on here. And this is popular in our day. Snarkiness, demeaning jokes, put downs, right? So we need to be careful. Our words have power. You know what's amazing about Tobiah too? Tobiah is a Jewish name. His name means Yahweh is good. And he grew up around Jerusalem. Some of you here, you grow up in the church. You're exposed to the gospel. You know the light. But your words are used in dark, demeaning, tearing down ways. Are you a Tobiah in the church? Do you tear it down? Or are you like Nehemiah and others who build up, who want to build up the work, build up the church? It's a good question to ask yourself. So we see here dangerous words supplemented with dangerous weapons, right? The whole army of Samaria. And they're trying to demoralize the team of the Jews. They're trying to disrupt the work and dishearten the workers. But the Jews under Nehemiah's leadership pressed on. They responded by praying. And prayer is so crucial. Anytime you go through pain, anytime you go through discouragement, anytime you're tempted to just despair, turn it back to God. And I love that. And that's what Nehemiah does. Look at verse 4 and 5. Nehemiah is a good leader. He's a leader who prays. Hear, O our God, for we are despised, he says. Turn back their taunts on their own heads and give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captives. Do not cover their guilt and let not their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders. Nehemiah prays. He says, God, crush our enemies. This is a bold and passionate prayer. Lord, come help us, vindicate us, defend us. We need you. This is not right what these people are doing. It's a cry for justice. And in verse 6, this is a powerful rebuke in my opinion. It's a powerful but subtle rebuke. Verse 6, so we built the wall. Derek Kidner says this about that. The sturdy simplicity of verse 6, so we built the wall, make Sanballat, Tobiah, and their friends appear rather small and petty, dwarfed by the faith, unity, and energy of the Jews. See, they just pressed on. It says, so we built the wall, and all the wall was joined together to half its height. So this is actually a good strategy. They completed the whole circle of the wall, or the ring of the wall, you might say, to half its height. They didn't just say, okay, this part is torn down, let's build it up to its full height, but we have other openings around the wall. Does that make sense? So they closed the ring of the wall, but it's only half of its height. So the enemy can still get in, right? But it's going to be a little bit tougher. They have to at least crawl over a wall. And if you're crawling over a wall with a coat of mail and a sword, it's a little awkward. So it's a good defensive position. I love this. Throughout the chapter, you're going to see they not only pray, but they protect. So prayer, they trust in God's sovereignty, but they also pick up their swords and fight. You know, sometimes we tend to lean towards one or the other. You know, we're like, oh, we'll just pray about it. Like, if someone breaks into my house, I'm not just going to pray about it. I'm going to pray about it and grab my machete and go downstairs. Right? I keep a machete next to my bed and a hammer, just in case. You know, you never know if you need it. But the point being, you have the right to defend yourself as a Christian. So you want to, if someone's coming into my house to fight my family, I'm going to pray and I'm going to pick up a weapon to defend them. So I'm pro Second Amendment. You have the right to defend yourself. Now, as Christians, we shouldn't go out there and blast people. But if someone's coming to attack you, you can defend yourself. So we see this powerfully in this chapter. So the leader prays, but then we see more pain and even stronger opposition to the work. It intensifies. Look at verse 7 and 8. When Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that they were repairing the walls of Jerusalem and that the work was going forward and that the breaches were beginning to be closed, they were angry, very angry. And they all plotted together to come and fight against the Jews and to cause confusion in it. So when they saw the progress of the wall, they plan to attack the Jews, to stop the work. They wanted to stop the good work that was going on. They got a coalition and they surrounded Jerusalem. Look at this map. Sanballat and the army of Samaria come from the north. See, Samaria's in the north. Then you have Tobiah and the Ammonites. They're coming from the east. And then you have the Arabs coming up from the south there in Idumea. And you have the Ashdodites that are on the Mediterranean coast, and they're coming from the west. So they're literally surrounded by angry, vicious men who want to stop the work and cause confusion and destroy it. And so under serious threat and in extreme adversity, you know what the Jews do? They pray. Look at verse 9. More prayer. This time the workers pray. They follow in the example of their leader, Nehemiah, and look. And we prayed to our God and set a guard as a protection against them, both day and night. In desperate times, the best things you can do, the best thing you can do is pray. Share your anxieties with the Lord. Cast your cares on them. Acknowledge your weakness and confess your needs to the Almighty God. They prayed together. Notice that. We prayed to our God. There is something powerful about unified corporate prayer when we come together and pray for one another. I was encouraged with this with a small group of men even yesterday morning, just praying together for one another. There's a power and a protection that comes from that. Like their building work, their praying was a corporate activity in which they could help one another. And we can continue to do that for one another as we pray for each other. We prayed to our God and posted a guard as a protection. Again, God's sovereignty and man's responsibility. God will fight for us. Now pick up a weapon and a shovel and let's go to work. They don't pick a fight, but they don't lose one either. So as Christians, we have the right to defend ourselves. You know, weapons in the hands of the righteous is a deterrent to evil people. So I'm thankful for our police force. I'm thankful for the military. Romans 13 talks about that. They're meant to be in a position to make evil people afraid. If you're a law-abiding citizen, you should love the police. If you're a lawbreaker, you're not going to like the police, right? So I hope most of us like the police. As a Christian, you should. So we see more prayer, but now we see more pain. It's back and forth in this thing. You see pain and prayer, more pain. Now, this time, it comes from internal threats, discouragement. See, those words have an impact. They're starting to get pessimistic. They're starting to get worn down. They're starting to get tired. They're weary. Life is tough at times, and no matter how much we pray, its trouble can increase sometimes rather than decrease. Prayer is not a convenient device for removing life's problems, but a loving of God's provision for coping with life's problems. In Judah, it was said, the strength of those who bear the burdens is failing. There's too much rubble. By ourselves, we will not be able to rebuild the wall. And our enemies said, they will not know or see till we come on them and kill them and stop the work. So they were hoping on the element of surprise here. We're going to sneak up on them and stop their work. At that time, the Jews who lived near them came from all directions and said to us 10 times, you must return to us. So first, look at the exhaustion of the workers. The strength of those who bear the burdens is failing. They're overwhelming. They're overwhelmed. They're beginning to stumble. They're exhausted, right? You just picture the exhausted laborer reeling under the heavy load he's trying to carry. You know, discouragement reaches a tipping point and then depression sets in. And depression always distorts reality. It throws everything out of perspective. It's like Elijah. You just want to give up. I've had enough, Lord. I'm done. Just kill me. So the workers are exhausted, but look secondly at the immensity of the project. There's too much rubble. By ourselves, we will not be able to rebuild the wall. You know, at the start of the project, they had all kinds of energy and excitement, but as the weeks went by, they became overwhelmed at the daunting task. Huge stones and vast amount of debris had to be cleared away. The Babylonians had done a good job at destroying those walls in 586 BC. There's so much rubble. We cannot rebuild the wall. Pessimism is setting in, and it's a great problem. They concentrated more on their weakness than on God's strength. Nehemiah had to persuade his rubble rousers to focus on God's strong hand that was upon them for good. There's a lot of rubble rousers in the crowd. Their arms may be getting weak and tired, but God's arms remain strong and powerful. So first, you see the exhaustion of the workers. Secondly, the immensity of the project. Thirdly, you see the aggression of the opponents. Our enemy said they'll not know or see till we come upon them and kill them and stop the work. The hostility of the opponents was directed both at the city's builders and at their homes in the country. And so look at the extent of the discouragement. Look what they said. At that time, the Jews who lived near them came from all directions, said to us 10 times, "You must return to us. Stop the work. It's not safe. Come back to us 10 times. Who is this saying this to them? This is their families. The problem is no longer local now. It's not just with the workers. Now they're attacking their families out in the Judean countryside. So the wives and the children are saying, "Hey, listen, stop the work. We're being threatened over here. This is dangerous. We're terrorized. You must return to us." Imagine the dilemma they're in right here. And that's the way the enemy always works. The enemy always works this way. He starts by mockery, jeering. He starts with words trying to discourage you. Then he goes after the work itself. Let's stop the work. Let's attack those men. Then if he can't get to the men, he'll go after your families. He'll go after your wives, your children. And so we need to be men of prayer. Men and women of prayer. Men who protect our families. Men who press on through adversity and do the good work that's before us. And so we see this. Look at verse 13 and 14. They protect the most vulnerable parts of the wall. I love this. "So in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, in open places, I station the people by their clans, with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles and to the officials and to the rest of the people, 'Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome.'" Right here, you know what he's quoting? His prayer in chapter 1, verse 5. Remember that? He prayed to the great and awesome God in Nehemiah 1:5. He said, "Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes." So again, you see God's sovereignty. God is great, he's awesome, and man's responsibility. Now let's go fight. Protect the weakest parts, the most vulnerable parts. Let's do it. You want to see a man fight? Give him a sword and put him next to his wife, and his children. Right? I know I'd fight if that's at stake. But beyond this, there's more at stake. They're fighting for the city of God, for the protection of the temple, for the protection of the city, right? So they have a good purpose and a unified purpose. You can see here, even in their weakness, the unity is strong. And the burden of the responsibility lies with the men as heads of their home. Do you have a passion to see the God of the Bible worshipped in our area? There's a multitude of Tobias in our culture and even in our church. We need men of courage and perseverance who want to see God worshipped both now and in the future. The text continues, "When our enemies heard that it was known to us," so that element of surprise that they were hoping for was shattered. How? "That God had frustrated their plan." I love that. See, all the credit goes to God, and yet the men step up. It's both. It's both end. It's not either or. It's both end. "We all returned to the wall, each to his work. From that day on, half of my servants worked on construction, and the other half held spears, shields, bows, and coats of mail. And the leaders stood behind the whole house of Judah who were building on the wall. Those who carried burdens were loaded in such a way that each labored on the work with one hand and held his weapon with the other." I love that, right? So they have a bucket of rubble in one hand and a weapon in the other. They have a shovel and a sword, whatever, right? So they're, but I love this. They're coming together. And then Nehemiah says, listen, we're all spread out because we're each doing work on our area of the wall. Remember, we saw that last week. The perfumers and their daughters are over here, and this guy's over here working on the wall. Listen, I'm going to go around, and I'm going to have a trumpet guy with me, the trumpeter. And if something happens, if there's a breach in this area of the wall, I'm going to blow the trumpet. And then we rally together, and we're going to fight in that low spot on the wall or that opening in the wall, right? So he has a plan. And he says, if you hear the trumpet, rally together. Our God will fight for us. Again, you see man's responsibility. Work. Fight. Pick up your shovel. Pick up your sword. Let's go. We need masculine men in the church. The definition of masculinity is this: glad assumption of sacrificial responsibility. Glad assumption of sacrificial responsibility. You step up. You'll make a sacrifice. You'll do anything. Do you lead your families this way? Do you lead them with courage? Do you work hard? Are you willing to fight hard? Man's responsibility, God's sovereignty. Our God will fight for us. Again, it's not an either or, it's a both end. And then finally, we've seen pain and prayer, and now we see progress. But progress always comes on the backside of pain and prayer. Progress always requires pain. Progress always requires sacrifice. No pain, no gain. So we labored at the work, verse 21. And half the men held spears from the break of dawn until the stars came out. Do you think they worked hard in long hours? Break of dawn till the stars came out. I also said to the people at that time, let every man and his servant pass the night within Jerusalem, that they may be a guard for us by night and may labor by day. So then they took shifts at night. They didn't even sleep. I'll do it for 2 hours, then I'll wake you up. You guard these areas. So neither I, nor my brothers, nor my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us took off our clothes. Each kept his weapon at his right hand. These men stunk. They had the same clothes over and over. They didn't have time to change. It's like, no, you got to be ready. You got to be dressed. You got to be ready to go. Sword right there. Strong BO. All right, we'll deal with it. Let's rally together. Let's be men. And I bet you Nehemiah stationed himself at the lowest part of the wall. That's the type of leader he is. That's the type of man he is. There's no progress in anything without pain. The price for progress is pain. Do you want to progress physically? You want to get in better shape? It's going to be painful. The first time you get back into working out, right? You'll do a set of pull-ups. The next day, you will feel it, right? You go to boot camp at the YMCA. Your thighs are going to be burning for 3 or 4 days if you haven't done it in a couple weeks, right? The price, no pain, no gain, right? You got to go work hard if you want to progress in your life physically. Do you want to progress financially? You got to work hard at your job. Do you want to progress in your life spiritually? You think you're going to do that by watching reruns of Seinfeld and sleeping in on Saturday morning, not coming to men's Bible study, right? That's not going to happen. You want to progress spiritually. You same thing. It takes hard work. It takes not hitting the snooze button over and over, right? Or whatever it is. We want the 5 easy steps to Christian growth. We want to worship the God of comfort, not the God of pain. We just want 5 easy steps. What are the 5 easy steps? So then I can just continue to binge watch Seinfeld and relax. But I want to grow. It's not going to happen. Jesus said, take up your cross and follow me. Cross, that's an instrument of torture. That's a heavy wooden beam that you're going to carry through life. That's painful. Being a Christian requires pain. Being a disciple requires discipline. It requires sacrifice. Men, I encourage you, open the Bible in your homes. Lead your wives and your children to church. Anytime the doors are open, Let them take advantage of the means of grace. Put them in the stream of grace if you want to grow spiritually. Do you want to have a good marriage relationship? You must make sacrifices every day for the good of your spouse. Do you want to raise your daughters to be chaste and your sons to be noble? It will cost you, and that price is pain. It's physical pain, it's emotional pain, it's spiritual pain, financial pain. That's the price to be paid for progress. The great lie in our culture and in our day that's continually told is that there can be progress without pain. You can make money without working. Just play the Mega Millions jackpot. It's up to $1 billion now. You can be a billionaire. You don't have to go to work. Just go buy lottery tickets, right? It's like, no way. You can make money without working. You can be married without conflict. You can raise children without sacrifice. That's the same lie that Satan told Jesus. Do you remember the temptation? The devil took him on a high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to them, all these I will give you. All you have to do is just fall down and worship me. You don't have to go to a cross. You don't have to go through all that pain. Just worship me. I'll give you all these kingdoms and all their glory. And many of us take Satan's bait. We believe his lies. We worship the God of comfort. When it comes to sexual purity, we choose pleasure, not Christ. When it comes to finances, we choose convenience, not Christ. When it comes to your marriage, you check out rather than sacrificially loving your spouse like Christ loved the church. When it comes to church, you're a consumer instead of a covenant member. What's in it for me? How can the church help me? You're not a covenant member who's seeking to say, how can I better help the church? You're Tobiah. I'll sit back here and make fun of the church and criticize it and say, oh yeah, that program's all screwed up. It's messed up. The youth group, disaster. Do you know that goofy looking leader? I'm talking about Andrew Lattice. No. But no, the point being, right, it's like we can sit back and criticize like Tobiah, or we can say, hey, how can I make it better? How can I be a blessing? How can I pray for this? How can I encourage this ministry? How can I bless this person? I think the nursery's all jacked up. Well, fix it then if you think it's all jacked up. Or whatever, right? Like, how can you be a covenant member rather than a consumer? How can I encourage the work? Do your words tear down people, tear down walls, or are you building people up? Are you edifying people? Are you building the work? Are you on the good side of the work, right? Or are you on the other side trying to destroy it? And here's the bad news. Whenever you do a good work for the Lord, you're almost sure to be attacked. Whenever you do something good for the Lord, you are sure to be attacked. If you're ineffective and you're just kind of like a false prophet of old, like you're going to be well-liked, you're going to be pretty popular, there's not going to be much attacks going on because Satan's happy with you and many people like you because you're just wish-washy. It's like, yeah, I better not say it. So the point being, whenever you do a good work, you're almost sure to be attacked. Look at Jesus. He comes right from his baptism, a high point in his ministry. And what happens? The devil takes him out to the wilderness to attack him right away. Look at Elijah. He's on Mount Carmel in 1 Kings 18, confronting the prophets of Baal powerfully. Chapter 19, he's running for his life from Queen Jezebel. And he says, he's depressed and he wants to die. Lord, take my life. I've had enough. Whenever there's a high, there's going to be a low. Whenever you're doing a good work, a strong work for the Lord, there's going to be a strong attack, strong opposition to the work of the Lord. And so here's the beatitude we all hate. There's a beatitude that Jesus said that we all hate. Actually, there's probably many of them, but this one is probably the one we hate the most. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil things against you on my account. Rejoice, Jesus says, and be glad. Can you do that? Do you rejoice after someone insults you, persecutes you? Like, I don't like this beatitude. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Or listen to 2 Timothy 3:12. Indeed, all who desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. It's not you might be persecuted. It's will be persecuted. It's not optional. You will be mocked. You'll be disdained. You'll be despised. You'll be insulted. You'll be persecuted. If you identify with Christ, you will be despised. Look at verse 4. He says, hear us, O God, for we are despised. We are despised. But we shouldn't pray verse 5. We shouldn't pray verse 5 of this text, in my opinion, because we're on this side of the cross. Verse 5, he says this, do not cover their guilt, and let not their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders. That's a rough prayer. But what I do love about Nehemiah, what I'll say is it's a cry for justice. It's a cry for God to take vengeance, not he himself. They're going to defend themselves, but he's not going to go take vengeance. And yet, this side of the cross, Christians don't need to pray like this, or like some of the imprecatory psalms. Like, listen to Psalm 137, verse 8 and 9. It says, O Babylon, doomed to be destroyed, blessed shall he be who repays you with what you've done to us. Blessed shall he be who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rock. Now, you know what happened back in those days? This is what happened to the children of Israel. When Babylon came in and took them, some of the soldiers took their little kids, their infant kids, and picked them up by the feet. And they would just bash their head against a rock. That's what they did. And in this psalm, the Jews are praying about Babylon. Let's dash their heads against the rock. Lord, you do it. Get them back. That's what they did to our infants. Get them back. But on this side of the cross, you know what Jesus, you know what God did? God the Father said, Jesus, I'm going to dash your head against the rock. Your head is going to get pummeled. The Roman soldiers are going to blindfold you, and they're going to pummel your head, and you're going to be dashed so that the enemies can experience forgiveness. And we're all in that boat. We experience the forgiveness. So we don't pray this prayer anymore. We pray, Lord, have mercy on them the way you've had mercy on us. And we look to Jesus. We look to Jesus. See, Jesus is the ultimate Nehemiah who left his palace. Remember, Nehemiah was safe in the palace. He had a good job. He had it made. But he left all that and went into danger to identify with his people. Jesus left his throne above to come down and be identified with us. Not at the risk of his life. Nehemiah risked his life, but Jesus Christ gave his life. It cost him his life. And he did that for something far greater than the city of Jerusalem. There's a new Jerusalem that he's raising up. And those walls are called salvation. See, Jesus came into human history and he experienced so much pain. He too wept over Jerusalem. In Isaiah 53:3, we read, he was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Do you think he can identify with what Nehemiah is going through? Hear us, O God, for we are despised. Jesus went through such opposition, such pain. He experienced spiritual pain. He was tempted by Satan to take the shortcut and not go to the cross. He experienced financial pain. He was born in a poor family. And then it says the Son of Man had no place to lay his head. He was basically homeless. He experienced relational pain. He was betrayed by his closest friend. He experienced ministry pain. He was abandoned by all his disciples. He had financial pain. His family thought he was insane. Sorry, familial pain. His family was like, dude, you're kind of going crazy right now. Could you stop and come by us? Like, we're going home. He was lied about, falsely accused. He had his reputation destroyed. He experienced the worst physical pain. He was flogged, beaten, jeered at, pierced, bled, tortured, gasping for air on the cross as he's suffocating, pushing on those nails to get his next breath. He was the victim of cruelty and jeering. You remember they jeered at him on the cross. They said, he saved others. He can't even save himself. If he's the Son of God, why doesn't he come down off that cross? I even heard him say, destroy this temple and I'll raise it in 3 days. Ha! Yeah, right. What a pathetic loser. Mocking, jeering, abusing. He faced the worst opposition and pain imaginable. And he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus went through hell on the cross. And we're told in Hebrews 10, he was made perfect through that which he suffered. Jesus went through pain. He was a man of prayer. And he made the greatest progress in human history. And he says, pick up your cross, follow me. Being a disciple is not going to be easy. It's going to be painful. Christianity is all about losing your life in order to find it. You got to die in order to truly live. But death is painful. Look at all the apostles. They're all martyred for the sake of Christ, except for one, John. We say, oh, John had it good. Yeah, he was banished to an island. Like, John didn't even have it good. Like, pain. If you want to follow Jesus, it requires pain and hard work and sacrifice. You'll have to persevere through adversity. There will be opposition, especially if you're doing an effective work for Christ. There will be opposition. Are you willing to courageously press on for the sake of Christ? How will you be remembered? Will you be remembered as someone who sort of drifted through life, comfortably numb, smoke another J, let's watch, Better Call Saul, whatever, right? It's like, no, like, I don't want to be remembered that way. I want to go through some pain. I want to be faithful. Faithful to God through the suffering. And thankfully, we have a lot of people to look up to in this church who have been through tremendous pain and yet have been faithful to the Lord through it and have come out on the other side even more beautiful and more radiant with the beauty of Christ. I want to hear those words from Jesus when we stand before him one day and he says, well done, good and faithful servant. Will you hear that? Will you go through the pain for his sake? Will you go through suffering? Will you step up and be courageous in our day? Or are you just going to drift? Let's pray.